the full docket of oral arguments this morning. I need to announce that, unfortunately, Judge Williams, who is scheduled to preside this morning, is unable to be present here because of a family emergency. However, she has, of course, read the briefs. She will listen to the oral arguments that are presented, and after she has done so, the members of the panel will then confer and go about the business of resolving these matters. Our first case this morning is Chandlemyer-Bartels versus Chicago Park District. Mr. Simpson?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Kent Simpson on behalf of Kathleen Chandlemyer in the main appeal. The jury, by their verdict in this case, indicated that the employer, the Chicago Park District, committed a Title VII violation by firing the plaintiff 6 hours after her direct day-to-day supervisor, Andrea Adams, screamed at her in racial terms. And then, immediately thereafter, wrote a memorandum in which she essentially begged that the plaintiff be fired. The jury was presented a special verdict form in which they were asked the following question. Did Chandlemyer prove by a preponderance of the evidence that she was terminated by the Chicago Park District because of her race? The jury answered yes, and each and every juror member signed their name below that. The jury found that the plaintiff had presented evidence that the decision to fire her was functionally made by Andrea Adams for racially discriminatory reasons. The district court, in our contention, erred by substituting its judgment for that of the jury under Rule 50. Under Rule 50, the district court was required to simply search for some evidence in the record that would support the finding of the jury. Anything more than a mere scintilla of evidence would be enough to support the jury's verdict. And we would submit that the plaintiff easily met that burden. I will first, and it's also important to point out that under Reeves versus Sanderson, the Rule 50 standard requires not only that this court and the district court, for that matter, take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, but that the district court specifically disregard any biased, interested testimony from defense witnesses. It's our contention that that did not occur in this case, and I will present to this court, by way of argument, three different points. First, I will discuss the evidence that the plaintiff presented. Secondly, I will discuss the problems or theories, the various theories that the defense presented. And finally, I'll discuss the evidence specifically in light of the Rule 50 standard. Right after Kathleen Chandlemyer witnessed a 6-year-old boy being beaten on Park District property with a belt by his aunt,
Who witnessed that?
I'm sorry?
Who witnessed that? You said witnessed.
My client witnessed it, Judge. I guess, and this has been raised, and maybe just as a point of clarification, my client heard the screaming in the other room of the little boy. She then followed the screams into the other room. She saw the aunt with the belt cocked back about to strike the boy again. She saw tears coming down his face, and she saw red marks on his arm. She did not see the actual impact of the boy being struck, but she certainly saw enough that under the standards of the Illinois Child Abuse and Neglect Reporting Act and even the standards of the Chicago Park District regarding mandated reporters, she was immediately mandated to report what she had seen. The defense at some point has made a big deal, or at least Andrea Adams made a big deal about the fact that she didn't see the actual moment of impact. We would submit that that's a distinction without a difference. Functionally.
Okay, look, I just want to know who witnessed it.
Okay, thanks, Judge. So what happened then, as soon as she saw that, she went and had a discussion with Andrea Adams. And Andrea Adams told the plaintiff right then that that's how African Americans discipline children in their culture. And despite both, as I mentioned, both being mandated reporters, she didn't insist that Ms. Chandlemyer immediately called DCFS. She just said she couldn't call DCFS, the hotline. And then, as soon as that conversation ended, Andrea Adams got on the phone to the human resources manager of the Chicago Park District, who eventually signs the plaintiff's termination letter and tells her about this conversation. She also calls right after that Alonzo Williams, who is her immediate supervisor, and discusses with him about what Kathleen Schanelmeyer had told her she had witnessed. The next day...
Wait a minute. Just a second. Who was it who talked to Williams and to Roland after the incident on July 31st?
Andrea Adams.
Adams did?
Yes.
Okay. Did your client talk to either of them at that time?
No.
Okay. Okay, go ahead. Thanks.
The next day when Ms. Adams learned the next day, my client reported at the DCFS that night. They told her to call the Chicago Police Department the next morning, which she did. They went over to the house and made a safe child check. And the next day when Ms. Adams learned at about 11:30 in the morning that the plaintiff had not suggested, taken her suggestion that beating a child was a cultural thing, and in fact had reported it to the hotline and the Chicago Police Department, Ms. Adams became violently angry and spitting mad. She reiterated that beating a six-year-old boy was how African Americans discipline children in their culture, and she kicked the plaintiff out of her office saying, "I can't stand the sight of you." Right after that, Adams then goes back to her office and she calls Megan McDonald. And she tells Megan McDonald about what had occurred, and she writes a memo to Megan McDonald. The memo begins with the words, "per our conversation." And at the bottom of the memo...
Excuse me, Mr. Simpson, where's the testimony about that conversation?
That conversation occurs on page 443 and 444 of the trial transcript. And I would also acknowledge...
And that's where Adams is testifying?
That is where Adams is. That is where Adams is testifying. And
McDonald says that conversation didn't occur, right?
Well, what happened at trial was that Adams first says that it does occur, and then the defense lawyer prompts her and says to her, "Are you sure about that?" And then she steps back and says, "Well, actually, I'm not sure." After the Park District's lawyer asks her whether or not she's sure about it. Certainly the jury heard the evidence, the initial testimony, that she was sure about it, and it was within their right on a Rule 50 standard, which requires the court to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, to consider her initial response, which was that this conversation occurred. And I would note that the memorandum, in fact, provides additional support for the fact that this conversation occurred because it begins per our conversation, and at the bottom of it, it describes the incident surrounding the reporting of the child abuse. And it says right in there, "This is the last straw," and then it ends with the words, "Something has to give." Certainly the jury was entitled to conclude from that circumstance that Andrea Adams was advocating that the plaintiff be fired. The district court confirmed that there was no doubt that Ms. Adams displayed racial animus, and it is undisputed that neither McDonald, Roland, or Williams ever conducted an investigation into the plaintiff reporting child abuse. They didn't talk to Ms. Schanelmeyer ever. To this day, they still haven't talked to her about it, and they did talk to nobody else about it either. They did absolutely no investigation whatsoever. About 6 hours after the plaintiff was kicked out of Ms. Adams' office in a fit of rage, Ms. Adams stood physically next to my client as Alonzo Williams handed the letter to her, firing her, and the letter was in an envelope, and it was signed by Marianne Rowland, the head of Human Resources for the Park District.
I have a little problem trying to follow the chain of custody of this letter. Sometime around noon, I got to remember everybody's position. What was Adam's supervisor's name?
Her direct supervisor was Alonzo Williams, and then the supervisor Williams. Ahead of them was Megan McDonald,
and sort of
in between that was this human resources person, Marianne Rowland. I agree with the court that there is some ambiguity about the letter, the timing of the letter.
Well, yeah, the letter has to be written, signed, sealed, and ultimately delivered. And it seems that Williams, for example, he's not aware of anything until someone tells him he's got to hand the letter over at 6 o'clock or something like that.
That is correct, Judge.
And then he backs up and of course, it's 3 years later, at least in his testimony, so he doesn't remember exactly the time and this kind of thing. I'm just wondering, because a lot happened before that day, And that's obviously what the city's saying, that this was a foregone conclusion. And McDonald had already explored it with her own email. And while this may have been, you can call it the last straw, it was the camel had already collapsed. We'll put it that way.
Judge, we disagree with you that that's necessary.
Not me. I mean, that's what the other side is saying.
Right. That is true. That is what they argued. I would support. I would point you a little bit, real quickly, to Boyd versus Illinois State Police, written by Judge Posner, in which she pointed out that there are incidences out there in which the amount of evidence of discriminatory intent is what pushes the plaintiff over to be being fired. In other words, there might be other issues, but if the deciding factor, the last straw, is some discriminatory intent act, he says in Boyd versus Illinois State Police that the plaintiff prevails. And I would submit that even if you have the concerns that you've expressed or that the defense has argued, that under Boyd, the plaintiff should still prevail. But more importantly, under the Rule 50 standard, the court in Reeves versus Sanderson, the court is instructed to disregard all the prior interested defense witnesses' claims about how this happened. The question at that point is only this. Is there more than a scintilla of evidence? Is there just some evidence that supports the plaintiff's theory? Because everything else was before the jury about all the plaintiff's alleged performance issues, and they decided in the context of this actual hearing, 4 days of testimony from all these witnesses, that the plaintiff was entitled to recover under Title VII.
Well, we'll call it this cat's paw theory. This influence has to be more than just a straw, doesn't it? I mean, we're talking about when you're talking about the person who's the subordinate that is basically orchestrating the superior.
Your Honor,
I think that's the standard.
Your Honor, there's no question that there are seven circuit cases like Staub and like Brewer that talk about singular reliance and blind reliance blind reliance is the standard, which is a very high one. I would concede that. And we know that the United States Supreme Court has granted certain stops, so there may be a different standard at some point on that issue. But we would argue and we would submit to this court that even under that higher standard, that the jury was right to conclude that Adams was the functional decision maker. There was enough evidence in this record, and the time frame was such that the jury had every right to reach the conclusion that it was not a coincidence that 6 hours before she's kicked out of Andrea Adams' office, screaming in a fit of rage and saying, "I can't stand the sight of you," that she's then fired. And the Park District's theory essentially is this is just a coincidence. And when you look at the circumstances and the timing of this, along with her direct racial statements that the district court even argued or found were racially motivated, there was enough evidence to affirm this jury's verdict.
Well, at least as I understand, the court correctly observed what Adams had said was pretty bad and what her own reaction was. And I don't know what ultimately happens to her under these circumstances of screaming at someone in front of the aunt and what have you. That doesn't sound like a very good way to operate. But she had put in a series of whatever these little notes that they sing, what do they call it, warnings, or it wasn't warnings, what do you call it, reports that you...
Incident reports?
Pardon?
Incident reports?
Yeah, incident reports.
I think you may be referring to the corrective memoranda that Adams sent to Schandelmeier.
But over a period of time. I'm talking about...
I would submit that...
Not the first time that Adams has been...
I think the plaintiff testified for 7 hours about her performance issues, and I would submit that the defense's brief way overstates the plaintiff's issues. She certainly had a learning curve. But the more important point here is that if you're going to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, as Rule 50 requires under Reeves versus Sanderson, and you're going to reject all the biased testimony from the defense witnesses, and you're going to ask yourself, is there enough there for the plaintiff to have met her burden and to affirm this jury's special verdict? We think that the evidence is clearly there under whatever standard you use. Even if you use Staub's blind reliance standard, there was enough evidence in this record to establish that Andrea Adams was the functional decision maker. And I can point to this court testimony. I mean, the district court said at some point that the testimony of McDonald that she made the decision to terminate the plaintiff 1 week before was uncontroverted. That was not true. It was controverted by all the circumstances and all the facts. And as Your Honor pointed out earlier, Alonzo Williams had no knowledge that the plaintiff, supposedly according to McDonald, this was a joint decision between her, Roland, Adams, and McDonald. But two of the people that supposedly made this joint decision on July 24th weren't even aware. They testified they weren't even aware that there was any thought that the plaintiff was going to be fired. Alonzo Williams said, I never advocated that she got fired, and the first time I knew anything about it is when I'm handing her the letter that terminates her. The other person out there that was there was Andrea Adams, and again, she didn't know anything about it as well.
The last straw memo is kind of hard to reconcile with an expectation that a decision had already been made, correct?
Absolutely. Okay. Couldn't agree with the court more.
Could I ask you, Mr. Simpson, what are we to make of Ms. Rowland's testimony that she was the decision maker? Judge Kaur said it's undisputed that McDonald was the decision maker.
I see. I guess I'm into rebuttal time here. But
under the circumstances here, I'm going to give each side an extra 5 minutes total.
That's an important point.
You turn the white light off, and when we get to 20 minutes, turn it back on, okay?
Thank you, Judge. Your Honor, I want to point out, because this, I think, is a very important point that I wanted to definitely address. The district court, in his opinion, says the parties do not dispute that McDonald was the actual decision maker. And that statement couldn't be less true. And as Your Honor draws testimony to, this is the conflicting testimony about who the decision maker was. Adams says that the decision maker is unknown. Williams says the decision maker was McDonald. Rowland claims that she was the decision maker, and not only did she make the decision, but that McDonald didn't have the power to be the decision maker. And then McDonald testified that it was a joint decision between her and Rowland and Adams and Williams. So there's at least four different stories this jury heard about who the decision maker was. And I guess when you look at discounting the defense's theory, I mean, unfortunately, plaintiffs in this situation aren't in a position, because there's no written policy about who's the decision maker, to really know what's going on behind the scenes.
About that, Mr. Simpson. Title VII just refers to the employer, correct? And it requires proof that, in this case, the discharge was, quote, because of plaintiff's race, correct?
Right.
The cat's paw theory is not set forth in the statute.
Correct.
Was it set forth in the jury instructions, or was the employer sort of just treated as a...
No, it was treated as a traditional Title VII case, and there was nothing specific in the jury instructions.
She'd been fired if she'd not been Caucasian and everything else had remained the same.
The jury instructions were pattern instructions that were agreed on by both parties with no objection from anybody, with nobody asking for any special instruction regarding cat's paw.
But... Do you think the Supreme Court's grant of cert in Staub ought to affect the way we look at this case?
Well, we think that the plaintiff prevails particularly under Rule 50, and that you don't have to get the cat's paw, and you can affirm this jury's verdict and remand it to the district court for future proceedings consistent with your opinion without even getting the cat's paw. Having said that, we also believe that even under the blind reliance, because there is certainly a split among the circuits on cat's paw, even under the stringent blind reliance standard, there's still enough evidence in this record for the plaintiff to prevail and show that Andrea Adams is the functional decision maker. And finally, we would say there's always the possibility, of course, you never know what the United States Supreme Court is going to do. They may come up with a different standard. It's my understanding the Solicitor General advocated a different standard than Staub had suggested. But in our estimation, it really doesn't matter. Whether it's blind reliance or some lesser standard, we still think the plaintiff prevails.
My point is, though, that whatever the Supreme Court might say, it would not affect, for example, the jury instructions that were given in this case. It might affect the after-the-fact judicial evaluation of that evidence,
right,
but it wouldn't call the verdict into question.
Correct.
Even if they alter
the
standard.
There's no issue.
Let me ask you, we've got a number of issues to talk about, Mr. Simpson. I know we've given you a fair amount of latitude, and I want to rein that in a little bit so that we cover some of these things. We've also got the cross appeal or the alternative arguments with respect to the motion for new trial.
Correct.
Judge Kaur wrote at some length about the jury instruction issue and the jury question. Did he address on the record at any point the closing argument issue regarding your suggestion that the July 24th memo might have been, in essence, faked, or the issue of whether the emotional damages award was excessive?
I do not believe he addressed either of those issues. Regarding the first question, which was regarding the closing argument, they objected when I made the argument. He overruled the objection, and then they
bang bang.
They included it in their motion, and then none of his opinion addresses it. So it's just out there. As to the other question was the damages. Again, they raised that in their brief. He never reached that decision. So again, there was no discussion on the record at all about that.
Okay, we're getting into your rebuttal time with the extension at this point. Is there anything else you want to add right now?
No, I don't think so, unless the court has any questions. I'd be happy to stay here as long as I can be helpful.
I'm sure, but we have a number of other cases we're going to need to hear this morning. Some other folks who are anxious to get up here, too. Next, for the defense, we have Mr. Scope. Good morning. Mm-hmm.
May it please the court, Devlin Scope, on behalf of the Chicago Park District, also present in court today is my co-counsel, Heather Becker. Your Honor, I'd like to begin by addressing the Rule 50 argument. Under Rule 50, and there's no dispute that Reeves and the Seventh Circuit's case in Filipovich establishes the JMOL standard. The Park District does not dispute that. Under Rule 50, the district court had to view the trial evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. We do not dispute that. And determine whether the plaintiff was entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. The court can only overturn a jury verdict only if, after reviewing all of the evidence adduced at trial, it is clear that the plaintiff did not present sufficient evidence to support her claim. That is precisely what Judge Kaur did here. He didn't make credibility determinations or substitute his judgment for the judgment of the jury. First, Judge Kaur found that this is, in fact, a cat's paw case. That's because there was never any dispute that Adams lacked the authority to terminate Ms. Schandelmeyer. The sole decision maker concerning the termination decision was Megan McDonald.
How do we know that?
The July 24th, 2006 email, Your Honor.
Well, we've got testimony we've just been told about where Roland says she's the decision maker. Or that it was a joint decision. We've got McDonald saying it was a joint decision. We've got Roland saying McDonald didn't have the authority to fire on her own.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that's Mr. Simpson's characterization of the testimony, and I can directly address that. McDonald's testimony was she was the decision maker. When she said that, to the extent that she ever previously used the reference joint decision, she specifically said that she, in her capacity as the regional manager for the entire lakefront, would have to consult with Marianne Roland to make sure that she's following rules. That's exactly what she did.
How about Roland's testimony?
And Roland testified that Ms. McDonald couldn't make the decision without consulting her. That's consistent with Ms. McDonald's testimony. Ms. Roland also testified that she was the person that signed the letter and was the one who, in turn, handed the letter to Mr. Williams, who, in the presence of Ms. Adams on August 1st, communicated the decision. Does Your Honor have a...
Yes.
Okay.
I understand what you've just told me.
Okay.
But I have to take all this evidence with a very jaundiced eye.
Absolutely.
Given the Rule 50 standard here. Cross-examination of Ms. Roland.
Right.
Question. What I want to know is, when you say you fired Kathleen Schandelmeyer, what did you mean by that? Answer. I was the ultimate decision maker.
Your Honor, there was also a rule of completeness objection, and during the course of the testimony, Ms. Roland also elaborated that when she said that she was the ultimate decision maker, she was referring to the fact that she participated by consulting with Ms. McDonald and that she was the person that wrote the letter.
I understand all the spin, and I understand how the institution may work, but we're also dealing with a jury verdict against your client.
Understand. And Your Honor,
so why do you say it's undisputed then, for purposes of Rule 50, that McDonald was the sole decision maker?
because again, the email specifically says, because she is non-union and because she's still within her probationary period, do we even have to schedule a CAM or can we just release her from her duties?
Let me ask you about that,
sure,
that letter. Let's assume it's authentic, okay?
Which we can, since they stipulated to it, yes.
Is it reasonable to read that letter as saying, and as that memo is saying, in essence, I need to know what my options are procedurally?
She needs to know what her options are to make sure that she can follow through on the decision that she's made. I want to fire Kathleen Chandlemyer, but to do that, is there anything else I need to do to comply with internal...
Well, that's not the language of the memo, is it? It doesn't say, I have decided I want to fire her. In fact, it shouldn't say something like that as long as she thinks she might have to have a CAM, right?
Well, no, Your Honor, there's been spin, as Your Honor used the phrase, by plaintiff about the need for a CAM. The issue about a CAM was just making sure, do they have to do one, because they weren't sure because of Ms. Chandlemyer's union or non-union status.
Let me ask you the question again. Is it reasonable to read this letter as saying, I want to make sure, I'm thinking about firing Chandlemyer. If we do that, I need to know what legal obligations and procedural requirements are in place. But it never says, I am irrevocably committed at this point to firing Chandlemyer.
Is that a reasonable
reading of the letter?
Does this email say, does she irrevocably?
Is that a reasonable reading of the letter?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think so.
Why not?
Because Ms. McDonald, in the phrase, or do we even have to schedule a CAM, or can we release her now? She wants to release her now, and Ms. McDonald...
Could you quote?
I'm sorry?
Don't rephrase it.
Okay,
quote it.
Quote, because she is non-union and because she is still within her probationary period, do we have to even schedule a CAM, or can we release her from her duties? That's the quote.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Your Honor's question, just to make sure I'm on the same page.
Is it?
Because the CAM is required under...
In the next paragraph, if we need to schedule a CAM, please do that as soon as possible. If we don't, can we please check with Becca and confirm that we're able to release her? And that's right when she says, are we able to release her? She's saying, talk to legal counsel, make sure, because I have enough information now, I want to release her.
She doesn't say that, though, does she?
Does she say,
I have decided to fire her.
She does not use those words. No, Your Honor, she does not.
The CAM is required under the union rules, right?
Yes, and there's no dispute.
She's not in the union.
There was Ms. Chandlemyer.
She's still probationary. So the question is whether... The CAM is required, I guess at this point would be optional.
Correct. That would be correct, Your Honor. Now, Your Honor, there's never any dispute that Adams lacked the authority to terminate the plaintiff. And second, when analyzing the cat's paw issue, Judge Kaur viewed all the facts entirely in the plaintiff's favor. First, Judge Kaur found that there was never any dispute that Adams lacked the authority to terminate the plaintiff. He found that there was no dispute that McDonald was the actual decision maker with the power to hire and fire the plaintiff. He also found that there was uncontroverted evidence that McDonald consulted with three independent employees, that would be Alonzo Williams, Beverly Napier, and Mary Ann Rowland, about the plaintiff's performance. And by the way, the plaintiff never disputed the accuracy or veracity of the opinions espoused by Ms. Napier, Ms. Rowland, or Mr. Williams about her job performance.
What did Rowland know about her job performance?
Mary Ann Rowland was physically located at the South Shore Cultural Center.
Didn't she kind of back off of how much she actually had to say about her performance?
Actually, Your Honor, she didn't, because she was very unequivocal about one specific incident where she said that she personally observed Ms. Chandlemyer leaving a sick child unattended without adult supervision. And Ms. Rowland is also the individual in the middle of July who had to sit down with Ms. Chandlemyer and specifically told her, strongly encouraged or strongly suggested, that Ms. Chandlemyer look for another job in the Park District or just look for another job in general. That's not spin. That was her testimony. And that happened in the middle of July, long before anything that allegedly happened on July 31st or August 1st. And it is also consistent with Megan McDonald's testimony that she had a meeting with Ms. Rowland and Mr. Williams, and they all talked about Ms. Chandlemyer's performance, which coincides with the fact that Ms. McDonald also had a conversation with Beverly Napier. One of the big performance issues that Ms. Schandelmeyer had that was she was completely incapable of complying with the food service guidelines.
Mr. Scope, if I could, let me ask you a little bit about Judge Kaur's analysis. As I read it, it was kind of layered in terms of the analysis of the cat's paw issue. And I guess I have some concerns about the last step of that, where Judge Kaur said that even assuming McDonald saw the last straw memo or knew about the JJ incident before giving final approval for firing Schandelmeyer, that would still not be enough.
Yes, that's right.
My concern with that is if we make those assumptions, then it would be reasonable to conclude that McDonald was not being honest in her testimony about when she made the decision or being honest about whether she saw the last straw memo or heard about the incident described in it.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's correct in the sense that Ms. McDonald didn't deny ever seeing the last straw memo. She said that she did eventually find out about the JJ incident, but it was her recollection that it was sometime after Ms. Schandelmeyer was terminated.
Precisely. But Judge Kaur was saying, for these purposes, I'm assuming she did see it.
Okay,
and
yes.
Learned about it before she made the decision.
Right.
And if that's true, if you make that assumption, then you have to also assume that she wasn't being candid with the jury about the process.
I don't think that you have to assume that, and this is why. Because Judge Kaur also concluded that Ms. McDonald had conducted an independent investigation. When I say independent investigation, I mean she gathered information about Ms. Schandelmeyer's performance independent of the alleged bad actor. I'm assuming for purposes of this argument and for purposes of all the post-trial proceedings that Andrea Adams said everything that Ms. Schandelmeyer claims that she said, that and agreeing with Judge
Kaur. We have to make that same assumption.
And we have to.
And in fact, Adams testified, didn't she, that she remembered the plaintiff saying that her black friends did not beat their children, right?
Yes, Ms. Adams said that. I'm sorry.
Does she have any explanation as to how that sentence just appeared in this conversation?
Your Honor, there is a whole separate version of what transpired in that room that day on August 1st between Ms. Adams, the aunt, and Ms. Schandelmeyer. I would gladly tell you what that was.
But it may be beside the point.
It is exactly my point, that it is irrelevant for purposes of Rule 50 because I have to accept what Ms. Schandelmeyer said in the light most favorable to her, so as Judge Kaur did. And Judge Kaur assumed that Ms. Adams said everything that she said. But the problem is that Megan McDonald was the person that terminated Ms. Schandelmeyer. The same person, by the way, Your Honor, who hired Ms. Schandelmeyer. Ms. Schandelmeyer was hired by Megan McDonald. The plaintiff makes a big to-do of the fact that Ms. McDonald wasn't there, wasn't on site. But the fact is, and the fact remains, and Judge Kaur noted this, that Ms. McDonald specifically talked to people, talked to Beverly Napier. They were going to Ms. McDonald. They were saying, this is a problem. The food service is going to get shut down because we're getting multiple write-ups because of Ms. Schandelmeyer. She's a nice lady. She's a great artist. She has no organizational skills. We've trained her. We've retrained her. We are trying to work with her. And she's in her probationary period. Summer camp's almost over. Let's end this now before we get shut down.
Now, Williams also participated in that hiring, didn't he?
Yes, he did. In fact, the hiring tree would be specifically Megan McDonald and Alonzo Williams. Marianne Rowland was also present for the interview, and there were two. According to the record, there were two sets of interviews, a preliminary round and a final round. Andrea Adams was present for at least one of those rounds, and Megan McDonald, ultimately the ultimate decision maker in the hiring process, hired Ms. Schandelmeyer, for the record, over an African-American co-finalist. So Ms. Schandelmeyer was hired and fired by a Caucasian woman selected over a black candidate and ultimately replaced, for the record, and it's no dispute about this, replaced by a Caucasian female, Ms. Erin Jones, as testified to by Alonzo Williams. The plaintiff makes a big to-do about interested or disinterested testimony, that these folks shouldn't be trusted because they work for the Park District. What Mr. Simpson neglected to sort of glossed over when he was pointing at Williams and Adams is he forgot to mention the fact that Ms. McDonald, at the time, the entire time that this lawsuit was pending, was no longer working for the Chicago Park District. She had no incentive.
You think we should treat her as an unbiased witness?
Well,
and she was being accused of racial discrimination in
yes.
this decision?
The point is this. By her own testimony, Ms. McDonald was saying, I was the decision maker. By saying that, because when the plaintiff drafted her complaint or the various iterations of that complaint, they never specifically identified a decision maker. They never identified.
Do they have to?
They don't have to. I'm not saying that they have to. But my point was this, and Mr. Simpson said it earlier, I'm the plaintiff, I don't really know this stuff, only the employer knows. Well, in this situation, the employer, the decision maker, Ms. McDonald, the person that ran the entire lakefront, walked up and said, I was the one that made the decision. By doing that, notwithstanding her race, she was exposing herself to individual liability under Section 1981. Now, if she was really disinterested and she really wanted to duck and dodge, she could have just said, you know what, I didn't make the decision. By doing that, that shows that by admitting that issue, by admitting that fact in the face of possible liability, I think that really would show that she really did. That corroborates her veracity on this point, Your Honor, as does this email. There's nothing about this email that's suspicious or funky. Ms. McDonald is not an HR person. Ms. Rowland is. And Ms. McDonald realizes, hey, I want to make sure that we're doing this right because you never know. And she tells Ms. Rowland, talk to Becker Ryerson, our in-house counsel, who also is white. The suggestion that we have Rowland and McDonald, two Caucasian females just like the plaintiff that were involved in the hiring decision, talking to another Caucasian legal counsel, Caucasian female, about firing a Caucasian female would seem to me at least common sense, which is that it's more likely than not that race had nothing to do with the decision to terminate Ms. Schandelmeier. The evidence, as Judge
Corbin... Of course, more likely than not is no longer the standard.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Yes.
Go ahead.
When Judge Corbin analyzed the situation, the facts made it abundantly clear. All of the evidence reasonably would permit the jury to infer that Andrea Adams was a racist and she had and harbored animus towards Ms. Schandelmeier. The problem is, under Title VII, it's not unlawful to fire somebody. It's unlawful to fire somebody because of their race. Ms. Adams was not the person that made that decision. Ms. McDonald was. If Ms. McDonald did not harbor discriminatory animus, then Ms. McDonald's decision to terminate Ms. Schandelmeier is not actionable under Title VII. And which means that the version of the jury instruction to which the jury received means that the Harvard Park District was clearly entitled to prevail as a matter of law.
But the jury instructions don't, as I said, present this cat's paw theory to the jury. They just say, look at the employer as a whole,
right,
and ask yourself whether the plaintiff showed that she would not have been fired if she had been of a different race and everything else had been the same.
Right.
So doesn't that essentially sort of put the cat's paw issues to the jury?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. And the reason why is that Title VII, because Title VII is always the law. That's what requires it.
Which says
that you cannot terminate somebody because of race.
Right.
And so the evidence would show that McDonald was the person that made that decision.
The employer made the decision, right?
I'm sorry?
The employer made the decision.
The employer makes the decision through its agent. McDonald was the agent that made the decision.
You would agree, as I understand it, the plaintiff has admitted she had a lot of these problems in her performance that were identified, right?
She tries to downplay it, but she admits it.
She tries to downplay it. You guys try to blow it up to monstrous proportions. We understand that, okay? But we know that there were problems. We also know, don't we, that Title VII is not limited in its protections to flawless employees.
Oh, absolutely.
And if race makes the difference in tipping the balance between an employer who's willing to work with an employee in trouble versus getting rid of them, that's still actionable.
That's correct. But the problem is that Ms. Schandelmeier didn't show that her race tipped her over that line.
Well, what she's trying to show is that Adams made the decision because based on, if you take whatever she said at that confrontation, she had plenty of racial animus, whatever it was, in between her and Chandlemire.
That's
why it goes beyond, because if you look at McDonald, there isn't going to be much racial animus. She's more concerned. And, of course, there's also, I think, wasn't Chandlemire's son a participant? Yeah, he was. In fact, she was doing a lot of supervising over her own son during this process, and that seemed to raise a little bit of a problem with others. This is over this period of time.
Correct.
And I don't know. But that's why this thing connects, because without Adams, there's not any racial...
Your Honor, without Adams, I would have gotten summary judgment in this case. There's no doubt about it. And Judge Korsk explicitly said that when he ruled in the summary judgment motion, and he explicitly addressed the issue about why he let this case go to trial when he granted the JMOL motion. And he specifically said that he wanted to see evidence from the plaintiff about McDonald's role when this email was made and when the decision was actually made. That's what he wanted to find out, because McDonald's testimony and this email established that everything was a done deal. It was a done deal by the 24th. McDonald just wanted to make sure that she was following the rules to make it happen.
Why the delay? Why the delay?
Well, I can tell you right now.
Is it all just a coincidence?
It is probably the worst. It is probably the case of the worst timing known to man, Your Honor, in the sense that McDonald sends the email to Roland. Roland has to follow up with Ryerson. She doesn't hear back from Ryerson until the morning of August 1st. At that point, that's, according to her testimony, that's when she writes the letter. And
at that point, though, Roland already knows about the JJ incident, right?
What happens was, well, actually, I want to clarify that point,
Your
Honor.
There's testimony that she already knew about,
well,
right?
Well, there's testimony that she knew that there was an issue with JJ, and I think that we need to clarify something about that JJ incident. There really is two different components to it. The first component is that there's no dispute that Roland testified that that Adams told Roland that there's testimony that Adams, Williams, and Roland knew on the 31st about a problem with JJ, the JJ incident. The testimony was very consistent that Adams wanted to consult with them just to make sure that her direction to Ms. Chandlemire, i.e., if you think you saw something, report it, was consistent. Nothing on the 31st, or as according to the testimony, would suggest that Williams knew anything about a crazy aunt or anything of that nature, or Roland did. And Ms. Chandlemire never reported any incident to anybody about what happened in Ms. Adams' office on August 1st. Never said a word to anybody until several days after she was fired, and for the first time wrote a letter to the general superintendent of the Park District and said, hey, all these bad things happened to me on August 1st, and then I got fired. So nobody knew about alleged racial animus, not Ms. McDonald, not Ms. Roland, or Mr. Williams. All Mr. Williams, the only thing that Chandlemire, in the best view of this evidence, would be able to establish.
No, they don't have to have known about Adams' racial animus if Adams' racial animus, in the way she reported that incident, made it the last straw that tipped the balance, right?
Correct.
Correct, as a matter of law?
As a matter of law, correct. However, Your Honor, because the decision had already been made independent of that animus on the 24th, based on independent corroboration from people that the plaintiff has never alleged to have harbored any discriminatory animus, whose opinions of her performance were corroborated by documentary evidence, including plaintiff's own work product, or incident reports, the conduct reports, and the corrective action write-ups that were prepared by independent auditors who don't work for the Park District. They came in, they looked, and they wrote this up, and they said, this is unacceptable.
Mr. Scope, let me ask you the question I asked Mr. Simpson about the Supreme Court's grant of cert in Staub. Your thoughts about how that would or would not affect our evaluation of this case at this point?
I don't think it's going to affect it. First of all, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't truly believe that there's a true circuit split in the sense that all the circuits regarding the quantum of evidence, clearly some circuits require a higher standard quantum of evidence in terms of influence. Some are intermediate, low, but all of the circuit courts, every one of them, have all agreed consistently that if there's evidence that there was an independent, investigation, that the determination decision was independent of this bad actor, then there is no liability under Title VII. And I think that that's consistent with this court's interpretation and application of Title VII for at least a good 40 years, because it goes back to the whole idea, the adverse employment action must be because of discriminatory animus.
You think our cases are consistent?
I think some of the terminology sometimes can be a little could be left open to interpretation. I know that, for example, in the cat's paw issue, there have been references to blind adherence and to singular influence.
Why isn't the correct standard just to ask the jury, as was done in this case, was the outcome here different because of the plaintiff's race?
Well, I think
let the jury sort that out.
Well, the jury is allowed to review facts. They have to be instructed on the law. And I think that the law is always going to be the same, whether you want to call it a cat's paw or non-cat's paw. Was the decision because of race? Your Honor, see my...
Nope, not yet.
Not yet, okay.
Your Honor, in on it.
Okay, but if I could, Your Honor, I would like to address the other part of my argument, which goes to Mr. Simpson's closing argument. In his rebuttal, after I've already stood there for 5 minutes or at least 10 minutes pointing to the July 24th email, which was obviously based on our conversation today, a very key piece of evidence in our argument or our trial about how the decision had already been made by Ms. McDonald, Mr. Simpson, after having already stipulated to the authenticity of this document and having this document admitted as a joint exhibit, argued to the jury that it was fabricated. He said that this document didn't get. He suggested that they should consider, but not necessarily conclude, that the email wasn't created until after Ms. Schandelmeyer was fired. Now, there was no evidence at all adduced anywhere that this email was fabricated. The authenticity was stipulated to. Your Honor, I see that my.
Your extended time has now expired. Why don't you wrap up the thought?
Okay. There was no evidence. Our brief clearly shows that there was no evidence. It was completely inflammatory and prejudicial because it was essentially saying they're lying about all this, and if they're lying about this, Ms. Schandelmeyer should win because it was racial.
Thank you, Mr. Still.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal, Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honors. I couldn't have said it better than defense counsel just said it. This is a quote from what he said to you. He said that the plaintiff's firing was the worst timing known to man. That's what he said. And then he's trying to get up here and say, well, the jury had no reason to say that she was fired for racial reasons. The jury had every right to conclude exactly what he just said, which is that this timing is the worst timing known to man, and that they had every right to say, you know what? Really, that's so ridiculous that we know what really happened here. She got discriminated based upon racial animus. Now, there's a few things that he's said in his argument that I'd like to address, and I know he talked about this July 24th memo, and I'd just like to briefly talk to you. Under Rule 50, this court is required, once the plaintiff is shown more than a scintilla of evidence and any evidence that supports her theory regarding racial animus, to disregard any interested witness. And as this Your Honor pointed out, whether Megan McDonald worked there or didn't work there at the time she testified, she was working for the Park District when this happened, and she was an interested witness. And we believe that under Rule 50 in Reed versus Sanderson, this court is compelled to disregard her testimony.
Mr. Simpson, I'm pretty troubled by this incident in the closing argument. You want to address that? Since I didn't see any indication that you laid any foundation in the trial for attacking the authenticity of a document that you had stipulated to admit.
Well, I think that the comment was made in light of all the evidence, and I don't think that even if someone stipulates about its authenticity or its admissibility, that means that they can't comment on the role that the document plays in the case. It was our position or thought that the defense at some point would present some evidence showing they would maybe call Becca Rearson, who's referenced in this memo, who still works for the Chicago Park District, to explain, well, they had to consult with me and Cam had to be ordered. In fact,
well, that's what the stipulation might have bypassed, that, I guess. Yeah, that
well,
might have been good.
I don't think that the stipulation...
Maybe whoever participated and looked it up?
I don't think the stipulation was...
Was somebody checking on the need of a cam or not at that point?
I don't think the stipulation was intended to hamstring anybody's ability to comment on the weight that should be assigned to particular evidence. And if you look at...
I assume your stipulation was not a confession that everything in that document was true and reliable.
You know what it meant. I mean, one of the things that Your Honor pointed out and asked counsel about was whether or not that this memo could be read as we've decided to fire her, or whether it was more ambiguous about, well, we're not sure what it means. Again, that was for argument. The jury had that before them to determine what weight to assign to this memo. And they also had before them the testimony of Alonzo Williams, who's supposedly part of this joint decision, and Andrea Adams, who's supposedly part of this joint decision, who testify that until August 1st and she's being handed the termination letter, they have no idea that any decision has been made by McDonald to terminate. So, again, you have a situation where the circumstances allow you to recognize what the jury did in this case and come to the conclusion. And under Rule 50, there's just simply the question of what evidence supports the plaintiff. Your Honor, also in their argument, asked, I think, a very poignant question, which is, didn't Andrea Adams admit that she says to the plaintiff when she kicks her out of her office, I have friends that are black that don't beat their children? And Andrea Adams said, yeah, that's what I said. And then I asked, or we asked, on cross-examination, well, what was the sentence that came before that? She didn't know. What was the sentence that came after that? She didn't know. Again, under Rule 50, we're supposed to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. That's favorable to the plaintiff. It shows that there's no explanation for these racial animus statements. The other thing that counsel referenced was, is he claims that there was some investigation that was done by the Park District. And I defy this court to find in the record any investigation that they did. The bottom line is Megan McDonald did not go to Kathleen Schandelmeyer and say, I hear you reported child abuse, and I hear that you got kicked out of Andrea Adams' office, and I'd like to talk to you about it. And she didn't talk to Alonzo Williams about it, and she didn't talk to Marianne Rowland about it. And I say I'm out of time here, Judge. All right. I just noticed that. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement once Judge Williams has had an opportunity to listen to the arguments. Our second case.